You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
This is Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio with a message about Cookout NYC. Cookout NYC is the pinnacle event in July Good Beer Month. Cookout NYC will exclusively showcase the best of New York City breweries featuring limited edition beers and nationally renowned and award-winning chefs. A portion of the proceeds will benefit Just Foods Farm School. Community partners include Earth Matters, Teen Battle Chef, and the Kingsbury Community College Culinary Program. Check out cookoutnyc.com, co-hosted by Dixon's Meats, Six Point Craft Ales, Mama O's Kimchi, The Good Beer Seal, and radio hosts from Heritage Radio Network. Cookout NYC is the city's ultimate outdoor cooking and country fair event, July 10th from 11:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Governor's Island.
Welcome to this afternoon's program of Unfiltered, and apologies for the delay in getting started today. Coming from Manhattan, and there was just too much traffic. I always feel like we seem to think that we can beat it, but it rarely happens.
Well, you know, when we try to go out to the show when the show starts, sometimes it's hard to make it. So, but we're here, and we made it, and we have a cool guest today, and then we've beat the heat, and the air conditioning's kicking. Thank you, Jack. I always like to show up to the studio when I know it's going to be cool here at Roberta's, but we have a little bit of some news. I think.
We're just going to start the show on a somber note today. Sad news that our friend, our dear friend of the city and of the Heritage Radio Network, Ray Dieter, passed away over the weekend from a tragic bicycle accident. So our prayers are with his family and to the extended community that Ray touched, and just. Very good man, and very sad to see him go. So his show follows ours, and I imagine the amount of support that's going to be continuing to roll into the beer community, his family, and the extended community will be great. So
yeah. R.I.P. Ray, and hopefully you're in a better place right now. So
yeah.
But on a more positive and hopefully libaceous note. We have some interesting beer we're drinking right now. What did you get us, Lucy? Do you know?
The Atwater IPA.
Atwater IPA.
Okay. All right,
so,
cool.
So a little shout out to the beer folks here at Roberta's. And
And then just also a short note before we introduce our guest today, to talk a little bit about this article that was in the Daily Telegraph this past weekend, quoted, "Why the French Have Fallen Out of Love with Wine." And it caught my eye also because my guest and myself have studied in France before, and it talks about this younger generation who are drinking less and attach less significance to the convivial rituals that older generations have and are just drinking less than one bottle of wine a week, which seems
shocking,
right?
Shocking,
yeah.
Indeed.
So the article goes on to attribute some of this change in consumption to Asia, actually. Just that the inflated price of the product of wine within the country itself also goes hand in hand with this, you know, less demand from a younger generation because the prices have gone up. China has driven it to a greater sort of demand. And
but don't you think some of the prices, it's the Chinese are, well, there's two things. They're drinking the uber expensive wines.
Right.
And then they're also, there's a demand for some value in everyday wines, which I think that are coming from the south of France. So I think.
And Loire.
Yeah. So I think a lot of folks are. You know, it was always the very expensive wines were exported because the only people that could afford to drink them were at one point rich Americans, and now it seems to be rich Chinese. But, you know, do you think overall consumption is down because of a generational thing? Or
I think it's actually been happening for the past couple of years. This is not the first time I've heard this story. And so I think it's sort of been something that's been building. And as you said, the demand for French wine is certainly on the higher end. I think there's just been a general shift, especially since the economy in Europe has tanked along with ours, of people drinking less in general and going more for the fast food route and things like that. So I don't know, just interesting. But with further ado, I want to introduce our guest today, Cara Canella. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming, and apologies again for being late today. And Cara is a dear friend of mine and also a Brooklynite. So how long have you lived here?
Since 2003.
Okay.
I've lived in not every Brooklyn neighborhood, but quite a few. five or six.
What's your favorite neighborhood?
I think where I am now, Greenpoint. I love it. It's quiet enough, and yet there's still quite a bit going on. And
also a neighborhood that's changed.
Yeah, very quickly, even since I've been there, which has been a little less than a year. The East River Ferry is now coming there.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, right at India and the waterfront. And yeah, some great food over there, and probably has some room to grow in terms of wine.
Well, there's a great wine stop that I remember going to on Franklin Avenue. I can't remember the name of it, but it's just on the place from Veronica's People's Club. Yeah,
I forgot about Dandelion.
Dandelion, yeah,
great shop. It's close to where I live. And let's see, are there wine bars over there? Maybe I'm blanking.
Right, I don't know.
I feel like I would know them.
Yeah,
so
right.
I review some bars and restaurants for the Elle magazine, so I try to stay pretty on top of that stuff.
Yeah, I read one of your review on Colony. Has there been anything more recently, that you've written that is sort of sparked your interest?
Well, just last week I did an ideal menu from Brooklyn restaurants. So one course from,
that's cool.
All different restaurants.
So you did just kind of cherry pick something from each course with different restaurants, starting with a cocktail, moving into wine and then food. And
actually no wine.
No wine. Okay.
Wow. Cocktail and food. But maybe next time I'll suggest that.
Okay.
I had done something like that, but it was for fast food. And I decided what would be the perfect fast food meal of the major fast food chains. But
did it include a garbage plate?
From Rochester? No, but McDonald's did make it. Their French fries are pretty solid.
I would include the McFlurry for dessert.
Nice. I thought the Frosty from Wendy's was probably pretty solid. But, I did this many years ago before, everyone was into the blended smoothie frozen thing. But
I'm surprised McDonald's doesn't have a wine program. One of these days.
They do in France. They do in France.
All right.
Yeah. McDo?
Speaking of. Well, aside from writing, I wanted to take some time to introduce the series that you created in Brooklyn. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It's called Speakeasy Series. The tagline is Conversations with Artists and Entrepreneurs. So Aaron, our lovely co-host, will be one of my guests a week from tonight. It's Tuesday, July 12th, 8 o'clock at Brooklyn Winery, which is on North 8th Street. Really close walk to the L Bedford stop. And you can, a little plug, you can buy tickets on Brooklyn Winery's website, which is bkwinery.com. And if you go to the calendar of events, you'll see Speakeasy Series. So I started the series in February of this year and was pretty lucky to debut with this amazing Irish author named Colm Tobin. So basically, I'm just interested in exploring the creative process. So to me, starting a business, writing a book, making a movie, recording an album, they're all equally creative. Mm-hmm. And so I just love talking to people about how, you get things off the ground and make things happen. We all have these dreams, but how do you actually make them happen? And I think New York and Brooklyn in particular is a really inspiring place to be. I mean, just look where we are, Roberta's. It seems like someone's, daydream that's become real.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So
I think it still is a daydream, but...
Yeah.
But the dream keeps morphing every time we come back. So it's actually.
So what I do is I interview people on stage at a bar. It's been at Veronica People's Club, which is on Franklin Ave in Greenpoint.
And I've been to two of them. Both of them sold out. So buy your tickets now.
So the July one is at Brooklyn Winery, taking a break for August. I think in September I'm doing a walking tour about literary Brooklyn. My friend Evan Hughes wrote a book called Literary Brooklyn, so we'll be touring those spots, probably finish with drinks at the Brooklyn Inn. But I'm really interested in food and wine, and so one of the events that Aaron has been to was food focused. It was about Brooklyn food collaborations. So on that panel, we had Polly G from Polly G's Pizza, the brothers from Home, Evan and Oliver Hazelgrave. They built Polly's and some other places in Brooklyn and Manhattan. The girls from Ovenly, Agatha Kalaga, Aaron Patinkin, and then two really interesting guys working with fish, Sean Dimon from Sea to Table and Christopher Nicholson from Iliamna Fish Company. So
yeah, and Christopher's offer for the salmon just went out via Heritage Foods USA newsletter today. So,
oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a CSA at the Brooklyn Kitchen. Super interesting guy. He makes wine at Red Hook Winery and spends a chunk of the year up in Bristol Bay, Alaska, where he fishes wild salmon. And his family has been doing that for generations. And then he sells it here out of a CSA.
Mm-hmm. So it's really, in a way, I mean, given where we are today and the sort of platform of speak that we come to every week to talk about something new, in a way, your stage that you're creating involves different people's experiences. But over the course of the hour, an hour and a half that you host these, it really sort of brings to light some of the creative projects people are working on in different industries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And one reason I wanted to plan an event around wine is, you know, I feel the way about wine like I do about classical music to some degree. Like, it's so rich. There's so much to know. I feel like I've kind of just dipped my toes in it. And so the interviewer in me wants to ask you guys questions. But, I've sold wine for years. I've waited tables. I know enough to sell a bottle. But, you know, when it comes to tasting and just the history and terroir, there's so much to learn. So, mm-hmm. And that's basically what I do, is I plan these speakeasy events around areas that I'm curious about, sort of like continuing education for myself. And
excellent. Yeah.
Tell me about some of the producers who've signed up to do this with you.
Well, Connor McCormick, who's the winemaker at Brooklyn Winery, mm-hmm. and their two co-founders, John and Brian, and then Aaron and Stefan, who is one of the co-owners of Custom Wine Bar.
Excellent. Yep. Excellent.
So we're going to be talking mostly about local and domestic wine and, you know, how to make wine in Brooklyn and the region, and, you know, obviously talk about domestic trends because they all play a part in that. So,
mm-hmm. And how do you make wine in Brooklyn?
We'll find out next Tuesday. You have to come.
There's going to be a little tour as well. I haven't actually been to Brooklyn Winery yet, so I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
This is perfect.
It's a really beautiful space. I think it's 8,000 square feet, and they have a gorgeous outdoor courtyard. They have a parlor room, which is where our event will be. It's pretty intimate. You can, you know, rent out the space for weddings, events. So we'll see. I know that they get their grapes from the Finger Lakes, and last mm-hmm. week you guys had a Finger Lakes.
We did, yep. Steve Shaw, yeah. Shaw Vineyards, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And California, I know they're getting a batch of grapes from Chile. So, and Aaron, you spent time down there, right?
I did. Yeah, I did spend downtown in Colchagua Valley. But so it's interesting when you look at Brooklyn Winery, Red Hook Winery, Brooklyn Enology, you know, three different operations, which in the last, you know, 3 years have really come into fruition, I'd say, on a grander scale. So the conversation next week is really sort of going to hone in on how this movement in a way has come to light and some of the challenges and feats that have happened as well, right?
Yeah, and I'm also really interested in the do-it-yourself aspect of the Brooklyn Winery, where you can rent, you can get 20 friends together and sort of pay to make wine and divide the cost by 20 people. So it's really accessible and mm-hmm. open to people, or mm-hmm. you can just, you know, one family can do it. So I just think that's cool. Do it yourself, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What's the cost to entry in terms of like getting involved, and like, if can you just buy, you know, into a lot of say one barrel and maybe get 10 cases or?
I wish they were sitting here with me because I don't want to misquote their prices. I want to say it's around 5,000 to start a barrel or make mm-hmm. a barrel.
But sounds about right.
But yeah, I mean, next week I still have a lot of prep to do leading up to next week's interview, and I don't really, you know, I'll let them sort of
sure.
Speak
for I'm just saying for our listeners who don't really understand maybe how or why they would, what would be the benefit of them going, besides obviously the learning experience and the incredible feeling of doing it yourself, but going to Brooklyn Brewery or Brooklyn Winery or Brooklyn Wine Exchange or all these sort of do-it-yourself places. I mean, in a lot of ways, we the retailers out there are trying to drive traffic and get people to buy wine that is already out there. So what is it about that the person that goes there that is, I guess the person is the different, is the element.
Well, it's interactive.
Right.
It's an experience.
It's like going to a cooking school, except that, you know, you're interested in wine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, to me, that's really fascinating because, you know, the same person who is looking for their bottle of Pinot Grigio on Tuesday night, this is not maybe for them, but it could be the person that would take the culinary tour, like, you know, and do the week around Italy and or Tuscany and eat their way around and do some cooking classes. So it could be just
some serious enthusiasts.
Serious enthusiasts who want to make wine should show up at your event.
Right.
Okay. All right. Just trying to figure out how to pump it for you.
Oh, thank you.
And you can flip the tables on him at any time and ask him a really challenging question as well if you'd like.
Oh, just you wait.
Yeah, it'll probably be, what kind of pizza do I like?
Roberta's.
Yes, of course. The Speckenwolf, nothing but.
Now, in regards to your series, have you found that the people that you've sort of connected with over the years that you're bringing into this different light on this stage that you've curated, are they understanding sort of your goal, your focus, your creative vision for this? Has it been more of a pitch, or is this just a general sort of excitement to be involved?
Yeah, people have been really supportive, have been pleasantly surprised. I mean, there's so much going on in New York that I just feel kind of blessed for, you know, anyone to show up. And in order to get people to show up, you have to create really good content. So I'm working hard on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked mostly in publishing and writing and the food industry. So I think those communities especially are very supportive, and or maybe just they're the two I've worked in. So
no,
I've been lucky.
For sure. I agree with that. Yeah. I remember when you were working at Pastis, I think that was a couple years ago. I wanted to touch upon it because at the time you were witnessing so much on a daily basis there in the long hours that you were pulling that you thought that there was enough content that you could actually write a book about.
Right. Well, I have a lot of book dreams. But yeah, that was in 2004. It was right when I was starting graduate school. And it's a great experience. I think Keith McNally is a genius. He's really good at what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say you encounter, you know, a lot of interesting people, celebrities at his restaurants. And there's some really great books, you know, about working in restaurants. I like the one by Phoebe Damrosch about working at Per Se.
Okay, I know which one you're talking about,
Service
but I have
included.
Not read that. Yeah.
It's just sort of glamorous, like a fun sneak peek. And then you also see the not-so-glamorous side, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, every day.
Do you think the father of all those sort of, you know, behind-the-scenes books is Anthony Bourdain?
I think so, yeah. In fact, I started a food-focused book club several years ago, maybe around the same time. And we haven't read him, but you know, he's always on the short list of people that we're considering. We've taken a little hiatus for a bit, but
wasn't the one of the first books, Omnivore's Dilemma?
That was the very first book. Maybe it was a little later, 2005 or so. Yeah, and it's been pretty gratifying, the whole experience, because that book really changed the eating habits of a lot of the members of our book club. And then there's this ripple effect where they talk to their friends and family about it. And, you know, now those ideas are more mainstream. But when that book like first came out, a lot of people weren't thinking so much about.
I was actually really moved by that book as well. And it's funny because I went down to see Joel Salatin at Polyface Farms. And I took a little road trip with my wife and a big Coleman cooler empty. And we went and took a private tour with him and like had a one-on-one chance to really talk about sustainability and his farm and see the whole rigmarole. And he's like, the whole time he kept telling me that, you know, I normally charge $1,000 for a tour like this. And I said, don't worry, I'll buy enough food to haul back to New York that'll justify this little sojourn. And he was like, okay, don't worry. And so I've got some funny photos of he and I interacting and like, you know, like trying to walk and talk up like hillsides and mountains and chasing pigs. And you know, I did take about 17 slabs of bacon home with me. And so my, you know, but it's interesting because the Food Inc. movie, I think, was one of the things that sort of really pushed it for me to really think about it. And you know, I'd already had a wine company that was focused on sustainable wines, but you really think about the way that people have to live in order to, it's not just like getting back to nature, it's a purposeful march to in a direction that's almost counterintuitive these days, because it's easier to take a cheaper, less, you know, sustainable way out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing you're talking about is a similar thing even in writing. So the way that people focus on their art, it's almost the way that, you know, you have to come back around
right
to this topic.
Right.
Like, I mean, does that make sense? Or?
Oh, totally. It makes me think of that phrase, like, make a technology your slave, not your master, you know? And I think that's true when it comes to food production and concentrating enough to create something. And, yeah, I think it's something that we're all trying to balance right now.
Yeah, it is.
But it's also weird because if you see, you know, having being a classically trained French chef, I have killed chickens and seen how pork is slaughtered. And but they say, oh, if you see how a chicken is slaughtered, you would never eat it. And my I'm just the opposite. If I actually see what goes into killing or making a fresh, you know, chicken, you're like, you appreciate it more. It actually tastes better because you're like, wow, this thing, I know what it takes to make this happen versus like getting that piece of Purdue. I won't say Purdue,
stripped of everything,
stripped of it, and it's sitting on a diaper in a plastic, you know, wrap thing at your grocery store. People, it's so removed from the idea of everyday food. That,
yeah. Did you get to talk about wine with Joel at all?
I did. I brought him wine.
Oh.
And he was like, is this expensive? I said, yes. What does it go with? I'm like, everything you have here. Yeah. So.
Well, one of the cool things when I was eating at Colony one of the times, and this didn't make it into my review, but Colony is a great, you know, seasonal American restaurant on Atlantic Ave in Brooklyn Heights. And, you know, as I was sitting there, a farmer walks in with like a huge piece of, I guess it was pork, on his shoulder. And he was part of the collective that I think Joel Salatin is connected to, is Eco-Friendly Meats and or Eco-Friendly Meats, based in that part of Virginia. So, I just thought that was interesting that they're, you know, sourcing their meat from this really great spot. And I had this amazing conversation with the farmer, and it was his first time in New York.
Booming, oh, really?
Booming voice, cowboy hat, you know.
So it's probably a lot about relationships in that regard, too. Yeah. You know, you're going to come to New York with one pig and from Virginia or Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of, like, relationship building, and that's how Patrick at Heritage started too. So, mm-hmm. But I think the same goes true with wine. You know, after having worked a harvest, as you mentioned, down in Chile, there's so much more of a connectedness between what you're doing and then what you're later putting into your body. And I, over the weekend, read Alice Faring's book, which is a great book, Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, which really went into this whole schooling that a lot of people who are getting their enology degree go through to learn about the chemical processes of making wine and just the manipulation that happens in the industry, that until you're actually in the cellars working with the wine and in the tanks and the barrels, you could see the cheats that could happen, and they do happen on a very large scale. And until you can see the difference between how that is manipulated and changed in the winery and the ones that do much less with, you know, how they make wine, mm-hmm. you appreciate the differences of how much better they taste.
Yeah.
And just much more in balance. So
I'm really curious about biodynamic wines. Do you guys talk about that much?
We try.
It's still one of those subjects that, you know, it's more of a lifestyle in some ways, and it is kind of been pegged as a marketing tool in the past couple years too. There's a lot of sort of a philosophy of biodynamics, and if you choose to, it's like religion, you know, mm-hmm. it's like you cherry pick certain things out of Catholicism that you want to partake in. And biodynamics is actually there's several principles of it. So if you follow all of them, then you're essentially, you know, under that realm. But I think some people do some things and not all, or, you know, and so then it becomes confusing to say, okay, well, are you biodynamic or not?
Mm-hmm. Are you a Mormon?
Right. Oh, yeah. Can't you tell?
No, that's
by my outfit.
Yeah, cover up those ankles, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
That Amish skirt's working well for you. I like the way that's flowing.
Are there any other questions that you wanted to ask myself or Brian that you had been thinking of?
Well, how did you two come together? How did this magic happen?
Wow.
So you remember London? Is there
a no, actually. No? Brian and I have been colleagues and friends for about 5 years, 6 years, since the days of Bobo.
Oh, okay.
So I was the buyer there, and met him and his team and started buying some of the delicious wine from the Barter House, and fast friends. So thought it'd be good after launching At the Root of It 2 years ago. We kind of had a nice rapport and brought along a co-host to make it that much more fun in this little piece of a studio.
Erin needs a foil.
You get to heckle her.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I pick on her and she just gives me dirty looks, and that's kind of our relationship in a nutshell.
It's like Howard Stern and Robin, except Erin talks a lot. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to pass the mic at any point.
Oh, no, no. She's doing good today. This is all her today. I'm her foil.
So Speakeasy Series, it also has a Facebook page, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Twitter.
Twitter. How have you found social media helping your series?
It's been great. It's, you know, I tend, like your aunts who live far away tend to be very supportive. No, but it's also helped locally. I think, you know, social media is one of those things I didn't really understand until I kind of had like a purpose for using it, mm-hmm. you know, and this sort of focuses my use of it, and I love it. It's great. So now I'm kind of an advocate.
Excellent. You know? Good.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this old fashioned media here? Microphones, headphones,
studio?
Well,
I'm a Luddite at heart, I have to say. And I, in a way, I'm becoming more of one. So that's what I was talking about with balance. You know, we all have to figure this out. But I just finished Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. She just won a Pulitzer. She lives right around in Fort Greene, I think. And it's a beautiful book, and also, you know, talks a lot about like part of it is set in the future and people kind of communicating via these little things that seem like, you know, iPads in a way. They're called pointers. And so, you know, I just think like wine, I'm so interested in it because it's these old world methods, you know, new world technology is involved as well. But, mm-hmm. you know, the most basic things, like I think right now, in a way, we all become, you know, more adaptable, sort of like placeless. Like we can work from anywhere.
Right.
And, you know, communicate from anywhere. In fact, there's this like ad campaign right now for, I don't know, one of these, you know, internet.
Yeah, sure. Work from anywhere.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where they're like.
But unfortunately, the wine has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So terroir. Right. And that's a cool thing, I think, when it comes to fish. And it's interesting to talk to Christopher Nicholson about all that because he's, you know, really involved with fish and wine. And I remember one of the things I learned at Pastis, and this is not rocket science, but it was eye-opening to me. It was, you know, one of my first real exposure to oysters, I'd say there. And just how oysters are so, you know, influenced by where they're from, and you can taste like, you know, briny sea. And I just thought that was to connect that with.
And freshness.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's key.
So, I think place is, in a way, like more important, and the more and more that we can sort of all be anywhere.
So to wrap it up, give us our plug for where our listeners can find your event and how they can get there and the web, the whole thing. Give us your social media.
Thanks, Brian.
let us hear it.
All right. Speakeasyseries.com. And let's see, facebook.com/speakeasyseries, twitter.com/speakeasyseries.
Great name, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like it. Obviously, it has to do with speaking and then also this sort of fun. Like I interned last year at the New York Public Library for their conversation series called Live from the NYPL. So my series was definitely inspired by that. It's like the little more rough around the edges, like at a bar Brooklyn version, but I love it and it's growing and having a lot of fun. So
excellent.
Yeah, hope to see you Tuesday, and Erin will have a lot to say, and
I'll do my homework prior to then as well on the Brooklyn winery and the growing local movement, which is just pervasive. So thank you so much for joining us today. Again, this is Kara Canella from Speakeasy Series.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming. Okay.
Bye, guys.
And thank you, Jack Inslee, our producer and engineer for the show today, and putting up with our lateness. And we will see you again next week, 4 p.m. Tuesdays.
Or 4:10.
Or 4:10.
4:10. Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. It's with great sadness that we mourn the loss of Ray Dieter, owner of the DBA Bars and co-host of Beer Sessions Radio. Ray made this studio brighter every Tuesday at 5 p.m. with his larger-than-life personality, charm, wit, charisma, and expertise. We hope the archives of Ray on our station will serve as some kind of window into the life of a man who meant so much to those he knew and those he didn't know. And on behalf of everybody here at Heritage Radio Network, we thank you, Ray.
And they've been doing that for many, many years. And how do they get that barrel of beer? Did you ever hear of a place called Beer Mountain?
I have not, actually.
Beer Mountain is a place that I climb every once in a while to find barrels of beer for my customers. I go up there. I wear big, heavy boots. I carry a sled with me because there's snow and ice. And and I go to the top of the mountain, and I bring back barrels and bottles of beer for the people at my bars. And that's where I got it from, Beer Mountain.
You're awesome, Ray.
It's better for growing things. There's just more rain and more regular temperatures, not as harsh a winter.
Sure.
So it just became more economically viable to grow it there.
Can I just make a statement? I want to apologize to everybody that asked me why hops weren't grown in New York State, because I've told everybody there was a hop blight. I just pulled that out of my ass.
So why did you open a bar in New Orleans?
Well, everybody asks that question. The basic reason I opened a bar in New Orleans, down there, obviously it's a drinking town. There's a lot of drinking town. It's also a culinary town. They have some of the best restaurants in the country down there, and people told us we were crazy bringing a good beer, good whiskey, good drinking concept down to New Orleans, because all the people wanted was, you know, huge-ass buds. And that's all well and fine, and there's a lot of fun to be had on Bourbon Street, but there's a lot of shit going on down there away from Bourbon Street. And we opened up DBA in 2000, and we had a slow beginning because we had a pretty good list, and people were like kind of intimidated. But once the restaurant people, the chefs, the service people in the restaurant industry kind of got wind that we were down there and we had a great beer selection, we got filled up pretty fast. I mean, it worked out real well. And we opened our second place called Mimi's down there. And another aspect about it is down there, you know, a bar owner is a respected member of the community. We pay our taxes, we employ people, and we're part of the whole trade industry down there, the whole tourist industry. In New York City, we're not treated quite the same. And you know that as well as I speak. We're kind of treated as we're not a respected member of the business community as bar owners, necessarily.
So you like New Orleans?
I love New Orleans.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. Ray Dieter, a.k.a. Bootsy Collins, was just on the air. Ray, what was it like in the old days? Did you have a band or something? Bootsy Collins, Ray Dieter, DBA.
I play guitar a little bit, but yeah, it was kind of boring. The beer business is a lot more fun, Jimmy.
You're just too cool, man. I love you, man.
Ray, tell us the Tom Peters story. I know you've known him for years.
Yeah, you know, I have known him for years, and all the stories that I have about Tom, I cannot tell you on the radio.
How about a general beer theme story, like
okay,
the first time you met him? How about that?
Okay, the first time I met Tom, he was running a bar in Philadelphia called
Copa 2,
right. And he was, I went down there, DBA was a brand new bar. We went down there, and he was one of the most generous, wonderful guys. He's like, oh, DBA, I love you guys. Like, how did he hear about us? I have no idea. But he knew who we were, and he treated us like kings. And free food, free drinks. So generous. And then I found out that he didn't own the place. So it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense now.
If anyone's offering a course like that, it's a scam.
It's absolutely. I took a course at NYU about opening a bar, and it was just a fallacy. It was just ridiculous. They have no idea. It's all about math, too. And the math they talk about is really fun, but it's really not pertinent to what you do on a day-to-day living. Yeah, we need beer. Can somebody open some beer?
All right, I'm all over this. Give me a minute. Give me a bottle.
My glass is empty.
This is the first show. We haven't been drinking beer nonstop.
Right. Hey, Ray, how are you? How was your weekend?
You know, my New Year's was fine. I made a few bad choices, but you're supposed to. That's just what it is. New Year's is about making bad decisions. And I did that. But it, all in all, okay. I lived through
it. Like I say, we're the only brewery in the world. We have wooden oak casks. So
yeah. When are we going to get some casks?
That's the reason. I mean, these casks, We sell them in England. You can't ship these things across the Atlantic Ocean.
How about if we provide the casks?
Even if we do provide the
casks. When I say we, I mean by America.
Well, I can,
and by America, I mean Union. Union beer.
Cask beer, done the traditional way, as we do it, has a shelf life of probably about a week after it after it's brewed.
Yeah, but we have some casks coming over here. I know the Shelton Brothers bring some casks, and I know that the United Leather Importer brings some casks.
I mean, that's fantastic.
They're fine.
I'm really glad that you appreciate it. You know, that's great for you that you have the English cask beer. But, I mean, to be brutally honest, the way that we do things at Sam Smith's is that we are very, very traditional, and that's what we believe our success is based on, is sticking to what we do best.
But if IPA was made to be sent to India, and that's before airplanes and big steamships, I mean, if you really want to be traditional, you can, like, you know, we can get a donkey cart to come around south of Africa or whatever on a tramp steamer and bring it over. But I think it's time for Samuel Smith's to be available in cask occasionally for special events in New York. A lot of the beers in England, I mean, most of the breweries, the old school English ale breweries, would make a barley wine, but they weren't proud of them. It was something that they kept under the shelf, and it was something that, like, the old guy with the really greasy red woolly cap in the corner would get a little glass, and it was like, he would get a little bottle of it, it was about 6 ounces, and he'd pour it into his ale.
Yeah.
Because nobody would sit there and pound barley wine like we do here in America.
Right. Yeah.
And that barley wine that he was pouring into his ale.
It was fortification,
right. His ale was about 3.5%. It was a session beer. And the barley wine back in the day was probably about 6%, 6.5%.
Right.
And he didn't want to be seen drinking that because only old drunks drank barley wine. But that's a whole old profile.
Little nip.
Yeah. And now, so he would do, he would dip that little glass into his ale, and he would drink that. He'd sip that and quietly have a nice day.
Can't wait to be old.